words that people would know of. For example, you want to teach a kid a new word. If you just say it once, he will not remember it. So if you repeat it so often that he gets used to it, then you see that it becomes imprinted in his mind and in his heart. And as it's imprinted in his mind and his heart, now it is something that he can use. And when you use that word, his mind will go to the meaning. That's one way of establishing a knowledge in the heart and minds of people. Another way, if you don't have the time to do this, if you don't have the opportunity to do this, another way of establishing knowledge in someone's heart is by you transferring that word or that meaning or that information in an effective way. In an effective way that once it's done in an effective way, then you see that it will always be in the mind of that person. For example, how does this happen? Let's say you go on a vacation to Hawaii. And when you go on a vacation to Hawaii, you fall ill and you get malaria. Right? You might never have heard about this disease, malaria. But you got malaria in Hawaii and you were sick for a whole week. That was the time you were in Hawaii. That was your vacation. Right? Your vacation consisted of two things: falling ill and trying to get well. Right? So that 1 week you spend money to get ill and then to cure yourself of that illness. So now when you came back here, now you will see that word, which you never heard before, which is malaria, now has become a word that you are very closely related to for the rest of your life. Anytime you mention malaria, you will right away remember what that means. Right? You remember what that means. So what is this? This is an effective way of something becoming imprinted in your mind without having to repeat it. This is how, for example, we become friends with each other. We have relationships with each other. The reason we have relationship with each other is either we have lived together for a long time so that we know each other, or we were involved in a certain very effective environment, a very drastic environment, and we got to know each other. For example, let's say we are members of Al-Wilayah and we come over here. Even though Al-Wilayah doesn't have membership, you all are welcome to come. Right? So now what happened is that when you come to Al-Wilayah every week, you get to know each other. Hey, I know that guy. Right? I know that guy. He's from there. And you get to know one another after weeks and weeks and weeks of coming. So this is one way of getting to know each other. Another way of knowing someone that you don't know at all is to come together in a very drastic way where you become roommates. Now, you would never think that you would ever become a roommate with another adult, you know? But then you decide to go for Hajj. And then you end up becoming a roommate with another adult that you don't know at all. And you stay with him for 2 weeks. And you're like, you get to know what toothpaste he uses, what toothbrush he uses. You get to know, his personal hygiene and everything. And you're like, now you see that after those 2 weeks, a bond, a friendship is created because you're in an effective environment of being together, put together in a drastic way. So this creates a relationship, a friendship. You see how it happens. My friends, this is how Allah also has transferred knowledge to people. Sometimes Allah has repeated things over and over and over again until it becomes imprinted in our mind and we start to trust it and believe in it. For example, how many of us trust that the sun is going to rise in the morning? You know, we trust it. Right? Is there anyone who doubts it? You know, if I, in this speech, tell you, which I am telling you right now, that the sun will not rise tomorrow, how many of you will trust me? You know? In fact, the trust that you had in me, you will lose. What is wrong with this guy? You know? Maybe the fasting is too long. And you would lose trust in me in that sense. So now what happens is this, that when I am telling you such a thing, you won't believe in it. Because you have grown used to seeing the sunrise every day, that there is no way that anyone can tell you anything to believe otherwise. So now what happened is that that is something how Allah has established that knowledge in you. And Allah has made the sun rise every day, the sunset every day. He has given you rizq every day in order to build His own trust in you. Do you trust Allah? Everyone's like, I'm thinking. Well, you should trust Allah. Why? Because He has built His trust in you. Remember that. How He has promised that He will give you nourishment and provisions in your life. Tell me, has there ever been a day in your life that He hasn't? Has there been any day in your life that you can think of that Allah, on that day when I was 16 years old, I went hungry, I did not get my food? Tell me, has there been any day in your life that Allah has went back on His promise and said, I will not feed you? That He forgot to feed you? You can't think of it, right? Then my friends, what is Allah doing? By doing this every day and repeating it every day, He's establishing the knowledge of His trust in our hearts and in our minds. That's how we learn to trust Allah. By seeing our own experience. Allah, I have experienced You. I have known You. And You have never went back on Your promise. So there's no reason that I have to not trust You. He does that, repeating it. And sometimes He establishes His deen and His knowledge by sudden and drastic things that happen, by which we remember and which we get to think now. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Alright, let's hear louder salawats. Now the reason I'm mentioning this is because, you see, history is like this. Either in history you have events that are happening, small events that are happening every day or frequently, or you have major events that happen at once that shake everyone up. This is what's happening. And this is done in order to establish an understanding and a knowledge and give people something to think about. When we know that Imam Mahdi ajallallahu ta'ala farajhu sharif is coming back, he is going to return, reappear, and he will be amongst us very soon. So when we know this, now how do we prepare ourselves? How do we get ready for ourselves? Many people ask this question, right? Every time we see that it has become a trend now, sort of a fashion, to ask about Imam Mahdi, right? So it's a good thing though, it's a good fashion, right? You know, I mean, yeah, there's some fashions that are bad, like bell bottoms, you know. But some fashions are good. So this is a trend that's coming about, right? So this trend that comes about, you know, that people asking about the Imam coming back, what should we do to prepare ourselves, is a good thing, because it is at least being raised. Now, where is this coming from? Boys and girls, youngsters who are under the age of 40, trust me, this wasn't the case 40 years ago. No one was asking about Imam Mahdi. In fact, the subject of Imam Mahdi was something that is so distant to people. It was like folklore, like a tale, a fairy tale. It was like that. Elders would remember Imam Mahdi, you hardly heard about him. If you listen to the speeches of ulama 40 years ago, you hardly hear anyone speak about Imam Mahdi. He was never a subject of discussion. People were not interested. It's these 40 years right now that have changed everything. Now everyone is interested. So tell us about Imam Mahdi. How should we get ready for him? What are the signs of Imam Mahdi? What are the alamat of his zuhur? And all of these things are coming up. Do you understand where this is coming up? Why? What is making you think of these things? You see, something has happened big by which now we are questioning. Now we are inquiring. Doubts are appearing, so we are now putting a question mark and trying to learn. What has happened in the 40 years that has changed this? Anyone? The revolution. One revolution that happened, one scholar that rose up against an oppressor in one region of the world and said that, you know what, we need to establish Islam as a way of life and as a government, has made all of us like realize, wow, that could happen also? Yes, it could. It did in our lifetime. And hence now the question is, wow, so when the Imam will come back, that's how it's going to happen. You see, now this has led people to think, led people to ask questions, to inquire. And this questioning has led to knowledge. And more knowledge. And more knowledge has led to us having more and more of an awareness. And this awareness has led now us to actually do something about preparing. About preparing, preparation. That's what's going on right now. My friends, this is how it's done. One incident happens and now the ball starts to roll. The ball starts rolling and then people are getting ready. First they need to get ready in their minds, then they will get ready in their hearts, then they will actually get ready by their soul and their bodies. If the minds are not ready, the heart will never be ready. And if the heart is not ready, you will never be ready. So first the thought, the idea needs to come to the mind first. So this is the reason why Allah, in order to bring about the birth of the last prophet, is creating the grounds, preparing the grounds to get the people ready. And first make them think, to make them question, and then bring the prophet so they are ready for him. And that's where we are at right now. Why are we mentioning this history? This history is not some random incidents of events happening. This is a divine plan taking place. The birth of the Prophet is not an aberration in history. It's not an anomaly. It is providence. It is done by the will of Allah in the grand design that Allah has. That's where the birth of Rasulullah came in. And that's what we are discussing right now. That Allah is informing the world regarding it. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. So now, I told you yesterday that two powers, two superpowers, were at the time of the Prophet. One in the West, one in the East. The Western superpower and the Eastern superpower. So the Western superpower was the Byzantine Empire or the Roman Empire. The Eastern superpower was the Persian Empire. Both empires were the strongest empires at that time. The superpowers of the time. Everyone in the world revolved around these two empires. Now Allah wanted to inform them. The first, the Roman Empire, was informed of the coming of the Prophet through the oracle Sutay, who was in Sham. That was the doorway to the empire. That was the Byzantine Empire. There, Sutay, who was the oracle that everyone regarded with respect, the Roman Empire emperor used to take advice from him, used to take counsel from him. That emperor, he was informed that Sutay is making statements saying that the last of the messengers of God, the divinely appointed prophet, is coming and he is going to appear soon and all empires will fall before him. Every emperor will fall before him. He is announcing it to the people and hence it became public news. People were discussing it. The idea is coming out. Can you just compare that to, let's say, Imam Zaman, right now? I mean, really, how many people have heard about the Mahdi coming in the West? Can you imagine that? Now you see, how is it that now, I mean, when I was young and listening to radio shows or talk shows or TV shows, this and that, I mean, such things were not even a subject that would ever be discussed. It wasn't even there. Now, the people are hearing about the reappearance of the Mahdi and the promised one, the Savior, from people like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck. You know, the member here is not that effective as these talk show radio hosts. You know, they're the ones who are preaching to the people, oh, the Savior is coming and this is coming and Mahdi, and that's what they believe in. We would never reach that far. They're doing the job for us, but where are they getting that from? You see, again, the name of Imam Mahdi is being taken at the United Nations. And people of the world is being forewarned, hey, listen, the Mahdi is coming. And now, slowly, that is entering the minds of people to think about. It's there for them that they should think about it. My friends, this is the same way you see that people before Rasulullah is born are being trained to think about the Prophet in order that they can get ready for him. That when he comes, it won't be like, oh, who is he? Well, we don't know. It wasn't supposed to be a surprise. It was supposed to be a fulfillment of a promise and a prophecy. Rasulullah's birth was not a surprise, my friends. It was a fulfillment of a prophecy that has been prophesied by all the prophets in the past. They have mentioned that he's coming. So now these two superpowers are there. Sutay informs the Roman Empire. Now the Persian Empire. How did they get to know about it? Very short. I'll make it short so I can move on to another subject. Right? That is there. Now what happened is that the news reached the Persian Empire because the king of Persia at that time, he had a dream. In that dream, he saw that the new palace, the dream palace that he's building, has cracked into two. It was broken up. He saw it in his dream. Now, obviously, you know, for kings and people, rulers like that, dreams were like big things. You know, why did I dream this? You know, they wanted an answer. I want an answer. We poor people, you know, we just go to the Maulana and say, Maulana, I had a dream, you know, so what do you think? You know, he said, you know, so whatever he says will go. But the emperor, the ruler, when he has a dream, he wants an answer. So now, obviously, he has resources and money. He spends money to make sure that he has people around him who can answer and interpret dreams. So the Roman Empire, the Persian Empire has a dream that his palace is broken in half. He wakes up, is concerned because he is actually building a palace. And that palace is such that it is humongous and huge, and it's beautiful also because it is being made over water. It is such that when he will sit in the balcony, it's as if he's on water. All he sees is water. So it's like one of those beautiful places, you know, where he would come and this is his, you know, winding down time place. So this is being built, but he sees this dream beforehand. So as he sees this dream beforehand, he calls the people, the astronomers, the magicians, the oracles, the fortune tellers that he has hired. There are 300 of them, astronomers, astrologers in his court. He summons them and tells them, listen, what is the meaning of this? Go and find out. So they're all like looking at this, hearing this. Now, they're experts at what they do. They're doing their calculations, right? So 300 of them, you know, like looking at each other, said, all right, you know, we'll have to go and look at it. So the head of them, the chief astronomer amongst them, chief astrologer amongst them, says to everyone, all 300, go home, see what you can get, and come tomorrow, and then we'll see. So they all go home, and he also goes home, and he is thinking. Now he himself writes this in history. He is thinking about what this dream meant. He could not figure it out. And hence he goes and stares at the sky, and as he stares at the sky, he sees a huge light. A huge light that is coming from the west. He looks at that light and he sees it. It amazes him. And then he makes his calculations and understand, because they have knowledge of the books, they have knowledge of what's going on and what has been said in the previous histories. So they come together in the morning and they meet each other, and he says, listen, did you all come up with the same conclusion that I did? And he explains to them that this is my conclusion, that I saw the light of the last messenger being born. And obviously, according to their knowledge, he will be the reason that all emperors are going to be destroyed. All powers are going to fall. And they all nod their head. He says, all right, you know, so we know what this means. We know what this dream means. But can we tell him? You know, I mean, you're going to tell a king that you will be destroyed, right? He won't be too happy about it. It's like, you know, trying to tell your boss you're fired, you know? So, it won't go that easy, right? It won't be acceptable to him. In fact, you know, knowing the king, you know, he would just, you know, have them hung. He says, how dare you, you know, threaten me. So that will be a threat, and they didn't want to say that. So what they did is that they lied to him. They lied to him and said that, listen, you know, we were wrong in our head, because everything that was done in those days was done by calculations. For example, you want to build a building, you have to build the building at the right time. If you don't build it at the right time, there will be unfortunate luck. You will be, you'll face bad luck. That's why they used to look at an opportune time. You know, it's, for example, the Jahiliyyah way of doing istikhara, right? Even though istikhara is not that, but still, you know, that's their way of doing that. They would look at these things, you know, and it would be like, you know, bad luck right now to do it. So they said, we made a mistake in the calculation. Maybe this wasn't the way, so we need to build it this way. So we said, all right, so let's rebuild it. So they rebuild the place. It took 8 months to do that. Now, when he saw the dream, the day he saw the dream is the day in which Rasulullah was conceived. He was conceived that day. He saw the dream the same day, and they saw the light in the night on the same night. So now when that happened, the next step was that after 8 months, it was all done. It was all created, it was made. So now the king is going to open this place up. He goes inside, goes to the balcony on the water of this beautiful palace. He sits over there, and as he sits and relaxes over there, something happens, whatever it was, an earthquake or something, but the balcony breaks. The balcony breaks into the water, and the king goes into the water, and he almost drowns over there. He's almost killed. They rescued him, and he comes out, and he's like disheveled and exhausted, and he was like almost in the pangs of death. He comes out angrily, looks at these, you know, his astronomers, and says, what the heck went wrong? I thought your calculations were this and this and that. He blames them for it. They said, well, no, we made the wrong calculations again, this and that. It's a very difficult thing. So, you know what? If we do it in this way, in 14 days, it will be ready. So they get it ready in 14 days. In 14 days, it's ready again, repaired and renovated and remodeled. And then he goes again on top of that, and again it cracks. And this time, he says, all right, you know what? I'm going to get you all killed right now. Either you say the truth, or you're all dead. So now, they knew that they have no other way out. So what they did is that they said, all right, you know what? Either way, we're going to die. So here's the deal. When you saw that dream, that dream was because of the fact that the last messenger of Allah is going to be born, and he will destroy your kingdom and every other kingdom. Your kingdom is not going to last long. As soon as he said that, as soon as they said that and admitted that to him, he understood what's going on. Now he asked, is there anything we can do about this? Is there anything we can do about this? He started asking the question, inquiring about it, and you know what happened? The message spread throughout the Persian Empire that the last messenger is being born, and he will be the reason that our kingdom will be destroyed. You see how Allah is spreading the message. This is how now people are thinking about the last messenger coming. So now, when the messenger is going to be born, so one last event that had to happen for him to be born, and I said I won't mention it, but I was forced into mentioning it. So I will mention the one last incident so that we can all now get ready for the actual birth of the Prophet. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. There was a king in Yemen. He was a Jewish king. Yemen was ruled for a certain time by Jewish kings. It was the Himyari period. The Himyari period, the kings of Yemen, existed there about 100 and some years before the Prophet, you know, until, you know, you can say the birth of the Prophet. This was the Himyari period of kings in Yemen. They were Jewish kings. One of those kings was by the name of Yusuf. Yusuf, also by the name of Ya'athar, or also known as Zunawas. Zunawas because he had curly hair. Right? So, this king, Zunawas, was a very, you know, hardcore Jewish king. He loved his religion and he hated the fact that other people don't accept it. So when he ruled, he wanted to make everyone in his kingdom Jews. He was preaching Judaism and he wanted everyone to accept it, and he would offer it to them. If they don't, then, you know, by force he'll make them accept it. So he was doing that until he came across the Christians of Najran. Now, you know the Christians of Najran, they are the same people who came to meet the Prophet. If you remember that, they came to meet the Prophet and Mubahila happened through them. Christians who are from Najran. Najran was a Christian stronghold. Now, Allah has given another reference to this Christians of Najran in another ayat, which I will mention soon. So these Christians were very strong Christians who believed in Hazrat Isa. They believed in his teachings and they held strong to it. Zunawas heard about them and he was informed that these people, they're not going to convert to Judaism. They're very strongly adhering to the religion of Prophet Isa, of Jesus. So Zunawas goes there to them with an army. He says, well, I will threaten them, and through threat I will make them accept. So he goes to Najran and he surrounds the city, lays a siege on the city, and then forces the people to submit. The people submit to him, and hence Zunawas tells them, okay, either you accept Judaism, become Jews, or you're going to die. So the Jews, the Christians there, they say that, listen, the teachings of Jesus have now become a part of our hearts and our souls. There's nothing you can do to take it away from us. You can't do anything to take this faith that we have in Jesus away from us. So Zunawas says, is that your final answer? They said yes. And everyone is like in agreement with each other. Now, this is a city of people we are talking about. We're not talking about, you know, 5-10 people. It's a city of people. And they said, no, we will not leave our religion that we found and the love that we found and the religion that we found in Jesus for anything, no matter what you do. So Zunawas says, all right, you know, if that's the case, he has a big pit made, a big hole in the ground. He has a huge hole in the ground that is made, and in that hole in the ground he builds a fire, so it becomes a huge fire pit. And then he tells them, if you do not convert to Judaism, become Jews right now, you will go into this fire. And they said, no, we will not. And hence, after that, he starts to put them in the fire, hundreds and hundreds at a time, until thousands are burned alive in that pit. And this, Allah has mentioned it in the Quran as Ashabul Ukhdud. Qutila Ashabul Ukhdud in Surah Al-Buruj, 85th chapter of the Quran. He says, curse be on those who have burned these people alive. Allah regarded them as believers. He says these were believers and they were burned alive in the thousands. That was such a shocking event. It's like, for example, you know, how the Holocaust is portrayed. Just this huge event of how many thousands of people just burned alive. Zunwas just burned them alive. And now, out of that, one person, there's only one Christian that escaped that day. One person by the name of Davis. Davis escapes that day, runs away. The men of Zunwas go after him, but they could not catch up to him. He runs away, escapes that day. The only person from the Christian side who lived to tell the tale. He lived, he escaped, and as he escaped, he went to the Roman Emperor. Found his way to the Roman Emperor and gave him the news as to what happened. He says that the Christians of Najran have been burned alive. And we need to take revenge. We need to take revenge. So now what happened is that as they wanted to take revenge, and the Roman Emperor, looking at the logistics, knows that he is very far away from Yemen. So he writes a letter to the king of Ethiopia, Habash, Najashi. He writes a letter to him and tells him that, listen, this is what happened. Do something to take revenge for the Christians that have been killed against this persecutor. When Najashi hears about this, he is heartbroken. He is devastated. So he creates his army under a leader by the name of Ariyat. And this Ariyat comes in order to take revenge for the Christians that have been massacred. So he comes to Yemen, he comes to Najran with the army and goes to war with Zunwas. Now in short, Zunwas is defeated, he is killed, Ariyat takes over. Ariyat takes over and he establishes kingdom there. He establishes a vicegerency, not a kingdom, a vicegerency, meaning under the rule of Ethiopia. Yemen went under the rule of Ethiopia, so he's under the king of Ethiopia, Habash, and this Ariyat establishes that rule. So as Ariyat establishes that rule, one of his generals, one of the soldiers under him, a general under him, challenges him. He challenges him and says, listen, I am the ruler. I should be the ruler because I'm stronger than you are. He challenges him. Ariyat says, all right, you challenge me, so let's have a duel. Let's have a duel. So he has a personal duel, one-on-one, mano a mano, right? With this one general that's there, and he now, with that general and Ariyat, they fight. And in that fight, in that duel, Ariyat is killed. And his general takes over. The name of the general is Abraha. The name of that general is Abraha. And in that duel that he had with Ariyat, he had a scar on his face. And from that time onward, he became known as Abraha al-Ashram. Ashram means Scarface. So Abraha is Scarface. Because of the scar that he had on his face after the duel, he takes over Yemen. Now instead of it being a vicegerency under the rule of Ethiopia, he establishes it and makes it a kingdom that he is the king of. He is the king of this kingdom, and he establishes that. Najashi, when he hears the news that Ariyat has been killed and Abraha has taken over, is infuriated. And as he's infuriated, the news reaches Abraha. Now remember, Abraha is not royal blood. He doesn't come from a line of royalty. He's just an average soldier who was brave enough to take over this kingdom or this place. So it was his luck. So now obviously he's not someone who has that aura of being a king. He's lying, wanting to prove himself. So what he did is that in order to make Najashi happy, he shaved his head, sent the hair with the dirt of Yemen, and said, "This is for you to show you that I am with you and Yemen is under you." So when Najashi sees that, he's okay with it. He said, "All right, you know, but make sure you don't do anything wrong from now on, you know." He tells Abraha that. So now Abraha wants to prove himself, so he makes this cathedral. Now he's a Christian. He makes a cathedral, right, which is very tall. A huge cathedral, very tall, very beautiful, really nicely made. And it's so tall that, you know, I mean, the name of it, it means hats off. The reason it was called hats off is because in order to see all the way to the top, your hat would fall off. That's why it's supposed to call hats off. Right? So now this cathedral, which is hats off, you know, now he makes it, and obviously he's proud of it because this is the only achievement he made in his life, other than trying to kill Ariath and killing him, right, and taking over. So this is the only achievement he made. So now he wants to do what? He wants others to worship it. He wants others to come to it and glorify it. You know, my friends, unfortunately, this is a mistake that every Batil religion makes. Every wrong religion makes this mistake. You know what? When you do something for Allah, it doesn't matter who comes to glorify it or not. Because it's done for Allah, it is Allah who is glorifying it. Allah who is praising it. That's enough. It doesn't matter that. That's why you see all Batil religion, when they open up their places of worship, they want more people to come in. They want more people to come in because they feel that by more people coming in, that they will have credibility. That they will be credible because more people are coming. If only two people come, they'll be like, "Oh, you know what? You know, it's not, you know, made. It's not established yet." My friends, when something is done for Allah, really, it doesn't matter, right? If one person is there or a million are there, it's the same. That's why when Ibrahim and Ismail founded the Kaaba and Allah told Ibrahim, call the people, he says, "Adhin fin nasi bil hajj," no one came. Who came? No one came. Ibrahim is there, sitting there all alone, watching, you know, Allah, there's no one coming. You know, Allah says, "Don't worry. As long as you have done it, you are there, you did it for me, that's all that matters. You will go away, but the call will not go unnoticed. And a time will come that people will come, and there will come so many that no other place will have such people." My friends, this is how it is. Abraha made this place. It's Batil. The reason it's Batil is because now he wants others to glorify it. He wants others to come to it. So as others wanted to come towards that, so now what happened is that this person, Abraha, what he did is that he asked and he invited the Arabs to come. Now the Arabs used to go to Makkah and to the Kaaba. That was an established place of worship. They had centuries of attachment to the Kaaba. They did not respect this place. And it so happened that as he forced them to come, so they would come by force, but then what they would do is that they'll come there, stay there the night, and use the cathedral as a bathroom. Yes, they'd use the cathedral as a bathroom, they'd go there and, you know, do their business, you know, inside, and then they'll run away at night. So when Abraha heard that these people are disrespecting the cathedral, disrespecting this place, he was infuriated. You know, he said, "Now I'm going to teach them a lesson. I'm going to teach them a lesson." So that's why, and one of the reasons, he said, "We will go to the Kaaba and demolish it." So now, with that in mind, he came to the Kaaba. Now, you know the history. I don't want to repeat the whole history because you have heard it so many times from this point onwards. So Abraha comes there, encamps there between, if everyone has been to Hajj, and those who have been to Hajj, when you are in Arafat, and from Arafat you go to where? Muzdalifah, right? Then Mina, very good. So you go to Muzdalifah and Mina from Arafat. Now there is a way that the bus goes. Now has anyone been on that walking path that they have? Or have they all gone by buses? Those who have been for Hajj, right? Most of you went by buses, that's I know. But there's a walking path also for people who walk from Arafat to Muzdalifah. When you go through that walking path, you're actually walking in between the mountains. It is a valley, you're walking in between the mountains. My friends, that walking path is the place where Abraha's army was stationed. Abraha's army was stationed out there, encamped out there in order to attack the Kaaba. They came out there, they sent a letter to the people of Makkah, addressed it to Abdul Muttalib, and said that, listen, we don't want to fight you, we don't want to have war with you, we don't want to kill anyone, we are not have any animosity towards you. The only reason I'm here is just to destroy the Kaaba and walk away. That's it. That's all I'm going to do, just, you know, destroy the Kaaba and walk away, you know. Nothing big. Alright, you know, so Abdul Muttalib, you know, reads the letter, he's like, okay, whatever, you know, you want to do, you know. But so he says, you know, that all right. So as he hears the news, now some of the soldiers of Abraha, as they were going here and there, are stealing stuff from people, and they steal the camels of people. They stole the camel of Abdul Muttalib also. Now when Abdul Muttalib's camels were stolen, so Abdul Muttalib was a little bit pissed off. So he came there, and you know, he came to meet Abraha. When Abraha heard that Abdul Muttalib is coming, so Abdul Muttalib came. Now Abdul Muttalib, from the children of Hashim, was a very, as I said, Hashim and his children were very handsome people. They were big and strong, they were handsome, their looks were very respectable. When you looked at them, you had to be like, whoa, you know, in awe of them, you know, as such great people. They looked great also. They looked like they were this huge people, these enormous personalities. So as he saw Abdul Muttalib right away, and you know, Abraha was, you know, he's an upstart. He's not royal blood, right? So when he sees Abdul Muttalib, he's right away impressed by him. He's like, whoa, Abdul Muttalib, wow, you look like a, you know, a real king, you know? I'm just a, you know, a wannabe. So Abraha, you know, welcomes him, you know, sits next to him and says, please come here, you know? And so he says, hey, you know, I'm here to do this and this and that, right? So what do you want? So Abdul Muttalib is like, hey, listen, you know, your soldiers, you know, they took 200 of my camels. I want them back. Abraha, I mean, obviously he's a little bit mesmerized on one side and confused on the other side. He says, I'm here to destroy the Kaaba and you're asking about your measly camels? I mean, come on. I thought you were bigger than this. I thought you would come to me and beg me not to attack the Kaaba and this and that. You would be on your feet and saying, do not, this is our heritage and please don't destroy it, this and that. Abdul Muttalib is like, listen, you know, I own the camels, that's why they're mine. This house has an owner. This house has an owner, and the owner, if he wants, he'll protect it. Now, when Abraha heard that, and Abraha, again, as I said, right, Abraha is just a foot soldier, man. He is not someone who is royal blood who meets great people. So when he sees great people and great thinking and thinking that is beyond, he's like, you know, in a state of, you know, shock, wow, you know, like, you know, he's like trying to think what's going on. And so Abraha decides, you know, whatever, you know, you can have your camels back. He orders the camels to be given back. Abdul Muttalib comes back and tells the people, leave the city of Makkah and hide in the mountains. So they all leave the city and hide in the mountains there. And now Abraha the next day orders his army to attack. As the army attacks, everyone is looking at Abdul Muttalib. Abdul Muttalib is the leader. So Abdul Muttalib, what should we do? What should we do? Abdul Muttalib is saying, relax, be patient, be patient, be patient. The day is coming. They don't know what's going on. Everyone's hiding in the mountains. City is empty. And then the army is coming. And then he tells one of his sons, son, go on top of the mountain. And what do you, tell me what you see in the sky to the west. He goes up there. The sun goes up there. He says, I see a cloud. I see a dark cloud. And Abdul Muttalib says, all right, it is time for us to go back to the city. He tells his people, now it's time to go back to the city. Allah has made arrangements to protect the Kaaba.
Allah. 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 Allah.
And that cloud was a swarm of birds, small birds. And you know, Ababil, they came with three stones, one in their beak, two in their claws. They came there and they circled the Kaaba and went straight to the army, and they threw the stones on the army, each stone destroying everything that came in its way. Allah mentions that in Surah Al-Fil, you know the story. And at the end, the army was like straws, like for example wheat, where the inside is taking and nothing is remaining. It's as if it was an explosion that destroyed the inside and everything crumpled to the ground. Abraha was injured, but he was alive. He left there, he went away, and he died later. So now, this event was, because of its, you know, like its outrageousness and its complete, different, became an event by which people remembered time. It was an event that made a calendar for the Arabs called Aam al-Fil. Aam al-Fil is a calendar that was said after that everyone would remember each event by that event. For example, they would say, oh, I was born 8 years after the event of the elephant. I was born like 11 years after the event of the elephant. Like that, they would make time after that. And Allah wanted this to happen in order that everyone remembers the birth of the Prophet that happened 45 days after Abraha was killed. And this is now Allah's way of preparing Makkah, around Makkah, and the world for the coming of the last Prophet. Now we will, inshallah, go into the actual birth of the Prophet from tomorrow. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the tawfiq, the blessing to be on the right path, wisdom to understand His guidance, hasten the reappearance of our Imam, make us His helper when He comes. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Salawat ala.